Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on Monday afternoon, Monday, April 17th, a very big day because this is the last full day of campaigning up in Georgia's 6th Congressional District before the polls open at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning in, I think it's fair to say, one of the most consequential elections, certainly since the presidential election November.
As long as it turns out the way the polls say, yes, it could be. You've got, as long as Mr. Ossoff does well, but not too well if you're a Republican.
Yeah, that is, of course, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, whose column is in the Thursday and Sunday newspaper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog, which is available on AJC.com any time of the day or of the night. Loretta Lepore, who has worked for a number of Republican candidates, including working in the Sonny Perdue governor's office as, what was your title when you were at Sonny's?
I was the press secretary.
You were the press secretary.
And a very good one, too.
Well, of course you
Thank you, Jim.
Of
she better than Brian?
It was a different job. Different job than what I have.
Of course I was better than Brian.
There you go.
It was a different
Come
job.
Come on.
And
okay.
Those two voices belong to Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist and insider, and Theron Johnson, his partner in crime, a Democratic strategist. These two guys have been picking at each other now since this 6th district race got hot. If you have not seen us on Twitter today at PoliticsGPB, I sent out a tweet describing the lineup for the show about an hour ago. Brian, what did you tweet in response to my tweet?
Everybody, please tune in. Listen to Theron Johnson make excuses for John Ossoff on why he doesn't live in the district.
You know, Brian's just been so angry lately. You know, I think he's channeling his inner Donald Trump. So we got to be careful here.
This will be my Trump tweet. Ossoff doesn't even live in the district. Sad.
We're going to talk, obviously, a lot about the 6th district. I want to give you a few news headlines that are, I think, fascinating. There's been really interesting polling released today, and it's all over the map. Jim, I don't know if you've had a chance to look, but Gallup has a brand new presidential poll out. It says that an increasing number of Americans just don't believe President Trump's spin about his presidency anymore. It finds that only 45% of Americans think that Trump keeps his promises, down from 62% in February, a slide of 17 points. And that includes an 11-point drop among Republicans and a 9% drop among conservatives. And his ratings for honesty and trustworthiness are down as well. At the same time, Rasmussen has a brand new approval poll out today, and their poll says he's back at about 50% approval, the first time he's been there in 2 months. And then finally, and I found this really interesting, the Pew Research Center showed him today with approval ratings of 39%, no different than what he was at 2 months ago. The percentage of Americans who disapprove of Trump is virtually unchanged, 54% compared to 56% in February. 44% of Americans disapprove of Trump very strongly. So, you know, Jim, it's interesting because a lot of people thought that when he turned his attention to foreign policy, got away from all of the White House intrigue, and at least for a while seemed to, you know, stop tweeting all the time things that were controversial and outrageous. When the missile strike on Syria took place, now that he's talking about North Korea, that it might help his numbers. So far, Rasmussen is the only polling organization that shows that it has.
Yeah, and I'd have to see what the makeup of the what their polling world looks like. But you have to understand that all that foreign policy action, which might have been pleasing to your more centrist Republicans, also put off Donald Trump's hardcore supporters, who are non-interventionist, if not isolationist.
Yeah, well, it's just interesting. And we're going to talk about President Trump a little bit later in the program today. But we really, the 6th district race is really, right now, about the hottest political race that in the country. Brian Robinson, we always want to be transparent. You have a horse in this race. Although, We do have to say that as you've talked about it on the air, you have been remarkably fair-minded, as long as we're not talking about Ossoff, that is.
Right, well, let's get that. Exactly. Gloves are off there, right?
Well, of course.
Yeah.
All right, I want to start with something before we even go there, even. We all saw the news today. We've talked about it just a bit before we went on the air. Metro Atlanta seems on the verge of a total meltdown. We obviously have the I-85 bridge crisis with the bridge out over there. And now today, a portion of I-20, Loretta, has buckled. I don't have the information in front of me. East or west of downtown?
It's west.
And it's closed some 2-3 lanes, and they're trying to figure out what the heck is happening. We're about to be in complete paralysis in terms of transportation in this city.
We are. It's making it more and more difficult to get around the city, but people are starting to, I mean, just when people were starting to figure out their way with I-85, now they've got to figure out 20. All of the, you know, ancillary roads are backed up. And in my neighborhood, which they're cutting through, all east-west corridors, all north-south corridors, I mean, they are bumper to bumper in morning rush hour and evening rush hour.
And we've had two incidents at 3 a.m. in the morning that have shut down northbound and southbound lanes on both, one on I-285 and one on the downtown connector, just in less than a week.
Yeah, Jim, you all posted on Political Insider blog. People can go look at it there just a little while ago. An interview that our friend over at WABE, Dennis O'Hare, did with the police chief, right, saying he asked him, are we close to complete meltdown? And the chief said, we sure are. We're one incident away.
Yeah.
One incident, and maybe a bad rainstorm.
Yeah.
Right.
Where's this infrastructure bill, Brian, that's going to solve all of our problems?
Well, look. I think that he's absolutely right, but it's something the Republicans and Democrats have said for going back to Bill Clinton's run in 1992, that we are getting way behind on our infrastructure. You know, our highway and road network in Georgia is built for what Georgia's population was in the mid-1970s. We have not kept up with the growth of our population. And I think several things are going to happen. One, you're going to begin to see more and more Republicans demanding smart mass transit. I think that's going to be one of the changes that you see because, as Loretta said, there are a lot of Republicans coming in from green counties who can't get to work. This bumper-to-bumper traffic for way too long, and they can't get home. We may have a culture change in this area, too, where more and more folks work from home, the way I have adapted to doing, because it saves me literally an hour and a half, 2 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And with the technology we have, more and more, you know, Jim's a great example. Jim can work from home if he wanted to. Theron can work from home if he wanted to. I think more and more folks are going to be able to do that.
Theron, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was going to say the infrastructure bill that was passed in 2015 raises $1 billion a year. That does not cover all the costs of all the bridge repairs and infrastructure repairs across the state.
Yeah.
And so the DOT has a roadmap. They have the projects that are prioritized, but that roadmap essentially has gone out the window with these two interstate incidents. I mean, these are big lifts. These are expensive projects. The federal government's going to have to come in and help support in various ways. It takes a lot of time. The infrastructure bill that was passed was working off of a 50-year backlog. And so it's not enough. And so if you begin to weigh the pros and cons of this, is moving toward transit a better option? These roads have been heavily traveled, and we're not keeping up with the amount of travel that's on those roads. And education within, and we saw, right, last November, the city did approve a referendum to put money toward transit. That means more tax dollars that voters have said, yes, go ahead, tax me, but build the infrastructure, build the transit infrastructure, whether that's trains, whether that's light rail, whether that's buses. Let's do something to move people around the city more efficiently.
If you work downtown and you live in Lawrenceville or Suwanee or Norcross, doesn't all of a sudden a train that goes down that corridor sound like a fantastic idea?
Yeah.
I mean, they are living in, it's just Armageddon coming in from that part of the state. It's hard to get through Gwinnett, even without a bridge collapse on I-85. It's just so congested. So I think demand is going to be there because the need is screaming.
Well, I will tell you what. If the 6th District race goes into a runoff, that's when I think transportation and infrastructure become a very, very big issue. And especially so if we've had some polling that shows that his appeal is kind of declining. But if Bob Gray gets the Republican nomination tomorrow, it'll be a very, very stark difference between the Democrat and the Republican in this race.
Why? Well, to explain that to our listeners.
Well, Gray is a former councilman from Johns Creek.
Right.
And he has been part of a North Fulton contingent that has been absolutely opposed to the expansion of MARTA. You have on the pro side, you have Rusty Paul, you have
Mayor Jerry of Sandy Springs
and Jerry Woods in Roswell. But north of that, you start running into opposition, and Bob Gray has been part of that.
So let me just to make sure we're on a ground that everybody understands out there listening. When Loretta talked about the $1 billion infrastructure bill, she talked about a state. This was state money. This was we covered this extensively. All of us looked at it extensively. The legislature passed it after much commotion, and it did include a little help for transit. But Theron, when I said, "Where's this big infrastructure bill?" Of course, I'm talking about President Trump promised in it throughout his campaign, we're going to have a big, beautiful infrastructure bill. Now he's talking about maybe folding it in to a new health care proposal when it comes along. But it's not moving anywhere right now.
Well, I think it clearly shows what your poll just revealed to us is that the American people have they don't have any confidence in this president to do what he said he was going to do. I mean, if you look at what he attempted to do when he first got there was to replace and repeal Obamacare, I mean, that fell miserably. So, you know, to be fair to this state, and I think with Loretta and Brian and Jim's point, is that this unfortunate event with the collapse of 85 and now with the sinkhole-like incident that's happening on I-20 that's coming from gas and other places, I think it's forced Georgians to think differently about how we make a living. How do we provide resources to our family? How do we get to our work? And how do we get to daycare? How do we, even go see our parents who may be sick? I think that this incident, and I agree with Jim, is going to force people, primarily white people who live in suburban areas of this metro area, to really take a hard look about expanding transit here. Because let's not sweep this on the rug, guys. One of the reasons why MARTA has not been expanded, and quite frankly, one of the reasons why it was never expanded from its inception, was because there was people who were living in these suburban areas, primarily in North Fulton and Gwinnett and Cobb, who did not want MARTA to extend to their areas because they thought that it was going to bring crime and people who they did not want to come up there. So now in 2017, I think that with this madhouse of trying to get to work and try to get into this area, I think people are going to have a very open conversation about that. Now, what Democrats have got to do is that we've now got to figure out a way to work with President Trump, because I do agree with you, Bill, that by putting this now into this health care bill that I think is probably not going to come up anytime soon. If it does, it won't pass. What can we do as Democrats to urge our governor and urge our mayors and others and then our members of Congress, and hopefully it'll be John Ossoff who goes and represents the 6th District, how do they work together to bring back the necessary funding for infrastructure to this state?
All right. Well, again, for people who've already struggled with 85 and its problems, now let's hope that whatever happened out on I-20, they can find some solution for relatively quickly. Although, if you look at the pictures of the buckling, it's pretty intense.
And one last thing, and Jim, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I know that CEO Thurman and the CAB delegation put forth a bill dealing with T-SPLOS and SPLOS this session, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think it passed.
I think they fixed a T-SPLOS, a non-transit T-SPLOS bill,
yeah,
I think.
But my point is that
It was the city of Atlanta that wanted to go back and add a tenth of a penny that they had not put in there.
Yeah, but I vaguely remember.
Yes, DeCab did have a bill.
Yeah, they did.
And I'm sorry, I don't know whether it passed, but the whole point was to be able to extend transit along the Clifton corridor out to Emory,
right?
The hospitals and the university out there.
So now, just being mindful that what's going to happen for the next session, I think that this delegation is going to have to look at ways to you know, improve I-20, because there's always been a lot of talk about 85 and 400. But now what we've seen just happen, I think the cab has got to really be at the center of this discussion about infrastructure.
All right, let's we'll stay on top of that. And I'm glad you all, you are so well informed on this stuff, because these are important conversations to have. So thank you for responding to an emergency, a crisis that took place on I-20 this morning. Jim Galloway, let's talk about the 6th District race. You want to set the contest for us? There certainly was a time when Democrats were very optimistic that it was possible for John Ossoff to win this thing without a runoff. But over the last week, when we're not on the air, several Democrats who have come through here, Theron Johnson is not one of them, I want to point out, off the air have said to us, well, it's looking bleaker and bleaker for getting across the finish line without a runoff.
And I think that's so. I still wouldn't put it out of the realm of possibility because, number one, polls that have shown Ossoff, I think we've had one poll that shows him as high as 45. So and that's not a formula for winning 50 on Tuesday. But congressional districts are hard to poll. Special elections are even harder to poll, and we don't know for sure what the turnout operations in the Ossoff camp are. So it's, you know, they keep the Democratic mantra has been less TV, more organization. And we're going to see if Ossoff can pull that off. I would think that he'll probably finish, you know, in the low to mid 40s.
But the one thing that I think, let's just really paint this picture for our listeners. So you have very progressive, liberal, Democratic districts like Congressman Lewis district, which is District 5. Hank Johnson is a pretty strong Democratic district. Then you have, you know, David Scott and Sanford Bishop, who are kind of, you know, tough districts because they have a little bit more conservative voters there. District 6 is equivalent to being like a John Lewis or Hank Johnson district. If you look at the demographics and if you look at how Tom Price has performed there overall, it's one of those supposed to be Republican stronghold districts.
It's supposed to be. In fact, we had Fran Miller. We had Fran Miller quoted last week saying we drew this district to be a Republican district.
And Senator Miller, he always gets mad at me when I compliment him because I think I don't help him with his Republican base. But that was very honest. Unlike Brian, who wants to get out here and say that it's not a. I mean, this is a Republican stronghold district, and the fact that John Ossoff, a newcomer who Brian is trying to discredit, saying he doesn't live in the district and he's young. And he shouldn't run for office.
It's
leading the race. And so I can't help but think that I never would have thought, Bill, 6 months ago, that I would be coming on your show today, the day before an election in this district, and that a Democrat would be leading.
All right, Brian Robinson, you have an opportunity to respond.
Do you have a fight bell to ring?
Yeah.
Jim brought up the turnout operation for Ossoff. When you have $8.2 million, the better plan than having all of these ads, and literally it was like every other ad through the weekend in the Metro TV market was John Ossoff. They'd be better off to just drive buses through the neighborhoods tomorrow handing out $20 bills if you get on the bus and go to the poll, because they've got so much money that there's no excuse in not doing everything possible to get every voter to the poll. And they're pretty easy to identify.
I don't think residents of Buckhead will respond to a $20 bill.
Well, they're not in the district.
They will call the police.
They're not in the district.
They block you
up. Well, Theron, in Brian's neighborhood, $20 would be nothing.
Oh, man. I mean, Brian's neighborhood, it's full of these 3- and 4-car garages.
I would barter to about 60, right. 80 bucks.
You know what? It's interesting. Okay, Loretta, they've said some interesting things here that we should drill down on. There was an interesting op-ed piece in the Times this morning. I do get the sense that they may have held it a little longer than they should have, that they had it for a while. It's from Steve Phillips, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He says this, and I want to get your response. He goes along with this notion that putting money into TV, Ossoff's putting all that money into TV, has not been the smartest way to try to win this race outright. He says it ought to be for GOTV efforts, get out the vote efforts. And he says this, the cost of turning out an infrequent voter is roughly $30 to $50 per voter. Devoting just $1 million of Mr. Ossoff's enormous financial haul to such a program would increase minority voter participation by about 25,000 votes. And he suggests that if the turnout follows other special election lines, you should be able to win this thing outright with 75,000 votes. Interesting. It's not a lot of votes.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting market because you have the 6th District has to use the Atlanta media market, which is a very expensive media market for a congressional race. And so he does have to put expenditures into that race, being one, the preeminent Democrat. They've anointed him essentially their candidate in this race. But you do have to balance that with get out the vote, because you do have to do the door-to-door knocking in this day and age to win a congressional seat like that. He has a leg up in being the singular Democratic candidate with $8 or $9 million in the bank, and you have 11 Republican candidates vying for the majority of the Republican voters in that district with far less resources because they're distributed amongst the group. And so you have to do both in this day and age, unfortunately. And I think that here was a guy who's 30 years old, who's a filmmaker, who has relatively little life experience, work experience, political experience, and he had zero name ID when he came into this race. And he's put that money to everybody knows who he is. And in the postmortem, I'll go into what my thoughts are about what the Republicans have done to help raise his name ID. But he spent money wisely, I think.
All right. So I do want to, we're going to have to take a quick break. But before we go there, I love having my opportunity. You know, it's nice to have a microphone to talk about your own pet peeves. I live in the 6th District. I got a mailer yesterday from the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. It was a big oversized card, like many of them are. Here's one of the ways they've been spending money. It said, we've been tracking your record as a voter, and your voting record is, and then in big, big red letters, average. And I thought, I vote in every election.
That's kind of spooky.
For years. Well, of course, because it doesn't, because they're not really tracking voting records. They decided, the DCCC, that a way to motivate voters is to essentially insult them. this was not a good use of money, Democrats.
They're guilting you. They're guilting you, Bill.
Yeah, well, I read it, and a matter of fact, Jim, in Greg Bluestein's piece in the Constitution this morning, he pointed that out too, and that it was bothering voters.
I will tell you, on the turnout issue, though, the one thing that we have found within the AJC is that this is the same kind of voting pool that we had in November. This is a special election. I'm not saying that it snuck up on everybody, but we were unsure that it was going to happen until Tom Price got himself nominated and confirmed. So I don't think you saw on the front end, Democrats weren't able to engage and register non-voters, habitual non-voters.
And that's one of the other points Steve Phillips made in this op-ed piece he wrote today, was that was the biggest hope that Democrats could have had in the district, and it doesn't appear they've done it. All right, we've got to take a break. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB to join the conversation. Just to pick out one tweet we've gotten, Catherine Cummings tweets, why should Ossoff live in the 6th? 45 and his wife don't want to live in the White House and we're paying for it. All right, Catherine. We love you. You're listening, but send us another tweet in any minute now. It's Political Rewind at 2:30. We're going to take a break and come back. And speaking of tweets, let's talk about how Donald Trump has inserted himself in the 6th District race on the other side.
This is it. Today is the last day to support GPB and enter our drawing at gpb.org to win a King and Prince getaway for two to St. Simon's Island. This vacation includes a three-night oceanfront stay and a round of golf, courtesy of the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. No contribution is required to enter the drawing, but because you listen, we're counting on your support. That's gpb.org. And thanks.
In 1923, the wealthiest people per capita in the world were the Osage Indian tribe in Oklahoma, thanks to oil deposits on their land. On the next Fresh Air, David Grand talks about the serial murders that followed as local whites targeted the Osage for their money.
Here was a population being systematically murdered one by one.
His new book is Killers of the Flower Moon. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Loretta Lepore, Brian Robinson, Theron Johnson in the studio on this final day before the polls open at 7 tomorrow morning to vote in the 6th District Congressional race. Brian, Loretta, who's going to emerge on the Republican side as the likely runoff candidate?
I think it's anyone's guess myself. I think you have four Republicans that are in a viable position: Karen Handel, Dan Moody, Judson Hill, and Bob Gray. And to Jim's earlier point, the polling in this district has been a little bit erratic. And depending on the get out the vote, this is where the GOTV effort will really matter, is amongst those four candidates, how well they're doing, how well they've mobilized their forces, how well they've mobilized early voters. But I could not predict in this situation. I think it could be any one of them.
Brian, your candidate, Judson Hill, got a last-minute robocall from
Marco Rubio.
Marco Rubio. It'd be interesting to see
who took the 6th. Did he not in the presidential primary?
Thank you, Jim. That's correct. Marco Rubio did win the 6th congressional district in last year's presidential preference primary here in Georgia. It was the only district that we won. I was working on that campaign in Georgia as a volunteer, essentially. And we did very well in the 6th district, so it's a voice that matters there.
At the same time, a late endorsement for Karen Handel, Raina Casey, who was Donald Trump's campaign chair at the end of the campaign here in Georgia.
I think what it does, it allows at least four candidates to basically split up the Donald Trump vote.
Yeah,
which reduces its impact, I think, on the Republican side. I would note that Karen Handel in two polls late last week, including Landmark Communications and WSB, she was leading in that poll, and both of those polls were released on Good Friday, and then we went into the Easter weekend. And that's not a weekend that people sit in front of their TV sets and watch commercials. So I'm thinking that maybe a little bit of stasis has set onto the Republican side, and you may see her finally winning a Republican primary.
If those, whoa, that was casting some shadow there. Is that the phrase? Casting shadow?
Casting shade.
Yes, gosh, I am so not
God.
Cool.
You know, we know, now we know even more about his neighborhood.
Casting some shade.
I wasn't going to say anything. But no,
that was a reference to the fact that it's very hard for a woman in the Republican primary, any woman.
It sounded.
Now he's open to can of worms.
No, but it's true.
Oh, God. Now we could have a whole show on that.
Oh yeah.
And you can give me the microphone. I could talk for a full hour on that one.
Yeah.
Well, having worked for a female Republican presidential candidate last cycle, you would have a lot to say about that. But Brian, go ahead. Yeah. Respond to that.
Well, Jim's right, and both of those polls, Fox 5 and Channel 2. Had Karen Handel with a significant outside of the margin of error lead. Here's the issue. If you watch that Channel 2 interview, and of course, Theron and I were interviewed for that poll, the pollster said it's impossible to get a sample. It's just a soup out there. I have talked to colleagues of mine, friends who are working on other campaigns who have the resources to be in the field polling some. They say the same thing. That weeks ago, people quit giving serious answers. They started hanging up, getting frustrated with all the phone calls they were getting in this political environment where they're being so heavily targeted with all this national money. So we don't really know what's happening out there. There is no sample that represents the district. Now, I know that sounds like a cop-out because I'm involved in one of the races, but Loretta is right. Any one of those four could emerge. We don't know what was happening over the weekend with the mechanics. Maybe everyone did tune out. That's very possible. But a lot of votes have already been cast, so the cake is already partially baked at this juncture. But tomorrow night, it is anyone's guess. Any one of those four could emerge. But to Jim's point, I would feel a lot better if I were in Karen Handel's shoes seeing those two polls.
Yeah, but the one thing that we know that you don't need a poll to tell you, and you can try to spin it as far as, you know, all you want to about a sample size, is that the resistance against Donald Trump is real in District 6. And one of the things I want to go back and point out to you and Loretta's point is that let's just face it, guys. A Republican has not led in this race since day one. I mean, John Ossoff has been the beneficiary of the resistance that's been against Donald Trump since he's been inaugurated. And I think that this early money, this guy should not be crucified, Brian, for raising $8 million. I guarantee you, you would love for Justin Hill to have $8 million right now. And you would probably tell him that he needs to spend it. And one of the things that John Ossoff did so very well, which is why we're not talking about it right now because it is happening, is that he's had the ability to have the money that he needs to really compete against the negative attacks that are coming from the Republican PACs and Republican independent expenditures. And so this young man has been able to push back in a way that I haven't seen a Democrat do in Georgia in a very long time.
This I can promise you, if we had $8.2 million, we would be over 50%. I promise you that.
It's a Republican district.
I think one of the things about John Ossoff that has helped him with his rise is not just the anti-Trump sentiment. I mean, I understand that that's what the Democrats believe. But there is a changing dynamic in the 6th district. And if you look at over time, I mean, sure, when you have an incumbent like Tom Price who's delivering for the district, the majority of the voters continue to vote for somebody who's delivering for them, and he has. And being a doctor, having a huge medical community within that district, you know, I mean, there's no one underserved in the 6th district by healthcare. But look at the demographic. There is tons of technology and bioscience in North Fulton now and in that district, which has drawn in a lot of young voters. They can relate to John Ossoff being young. When the Republicans ran the Star Wars ad, every time they ran that ad, his numbers went up.
Yeah, but I disagree because here's the thing.
I'm giving you something here. To his credit, he embraced it. He didn't run from it.
Yeah.
He didn't shirk it. He stood up and he said, "Hey, I was in college. I like Star Wars." And every kid in America, every young voter in the district said, "Cool guy. That guy's got a huge cool factor."
But Loretta, you genuinely mean that, right? But there
I genuinely do mean that.
But there are people out there like Brian who wants to paint this guy. No, seriously, there's people out here like Brian who wants to paint this guy as 30 and inexperienced, right? And so what I think John Ossoff has got to do is not fall into this trap where he's only appealing to young voters. Young voters will not put John Ossoff in Congress.
Absolutely.
It's going to be people who are over the age of 45 and 50. So the kids' Star Wars name that Brian made fun of for like 3 weeks was to try to really discredit this guy. And while he did embrace it, one thing that I think was so very proud is that he started appealing to these older voters who I think are, again, disaffected Republicans who are pissed off at Donald Trump. To me, that's his pathway. All these right. young people.
I'm not saying young voters like. I'm not talking young like millennial age. I'm talking like people in their 30s.
All right, I want to jump.
And also on the older voters. Sorry, I know it's your show, Bill, but just one second. And on the older voters, I think that having that momentum pick up and him not shirking it, not falling apart, not collapsing, that earned him respect and credibility with the older Democrats.
All right, let me jump back in because I promised before the break we'd talk about Trump. Excuse me. Jim, overnight, here's what Trump tweeted. This was first just a glancing shot at the 6th district race. He said, "The recent Kansas election, Congress, was a really big media event until the Republican won. Now they play the same game with Georgia. Bad." We've talked about that Kansas race where the Democrat did far better than expected. And then he decided about 5 hours ago to take it head on, Jim. Here's his tweet. "The super liberal Democrat in the Georgia congressional race tomorrow wants to protect criminals, allow illegal immigration, and raise taxes, exclamation point." I think we know who he's talking about.
I think so. Well, it's...
Theron? Is it about Theron?
No, it's not about Theron. No, it's not about Theron. But I will tell you what, that tweet has the cadence of somebody other than Donald
Trump.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Jim, I swear you were reading my mind because Donald Trump, first of all, doesn't talk like that, right? First of all, he can't even put together a sentence that's that clear. What the problem is,
and there's no explanation.
And it wasn't typed before 6 a.m. Right when we know he wakes up and does what most men do when they get up in the morning. So this is the problem, right? Donald Trump now sends out a tweet before Election Day. Bill, I run a lot of campaigns in Georgia, a lot of campaigns. If we were to go to someone and tell them to send a tweet or an email or do a robocall before Election Day, that means that we are afraid how his or her support will affect this race. So you got the president of the United States of America, who you just pointed out is just dwindling in the polls, maybe, you know, coming up a little bit, is sending out a tweet. And see, I think that this is going to be so important. When Donald Trump and Air Force One lands here next week for the NRA convention, and I'm sure Brian will be there holding his Republican car in his pocket, is now what does Donald Trump do? Because to Loretta's point, Donald Trump is the best person that can motivate Democrats better than anyone in the country.
I don't think that was my point.
No, but I'm saying, how do they deal with Donald Trump coming, you know, the effect of John Ossoff and millennials? You want to talk about 30-year-olds and older voters, Democrats.
Brian, I wonder if Theron hasn't made a good point here. It strikes me that Donald Trump, given that we do know, or at least we think we know, that Democrats are much more energized to go to the polls than Republicans, maybe Donald Trump ought to stay out of this entirely, because the minute he gets involved, it seems to me he might add to that energy, don't you think? Wouldn't you rather, as a guy who's running a campaign, of Judson Hill, we should point out, wouldn't you rather he just stay out of this thing?
Where Donald Trump could be very influential, if he so chose, would be to pick from among the four leading Republicans. That is where he could have a giant footstep if he wanted to have it. And I can tell you, Judson Hill, Bob Gray, Karen Hand, all of them would happily accept that endorsement, because it would be a king-making endorsement in this race. Republican voters, self-identified Republicans, are very happy with the job that Donald Trump is doing, even if they were uncomfortable with him last year during the campaign and his rhetoric. Even if they didn't vote for him in the primary, which in our district, most people didn't. But now they've got Neil Gorsuch on the court. We're seeing a strong foreign policy for the first time in 8 years. We're seeing talk about a tax cut in a very high-income district that would benefit from lower marginal rates. Well, there are a lot of reasons for Republicans to like Donald Trump right now, even if they don't like his tweeting. So that would be where it would make a difference. Are Democrats mobilized? Do we have this large independent base in the district that is probably actively against Trump? Yes. That's why him coming in and going after Ossoff may not be a great strategy. But you know who could do that? Mike Pence.
Yeah.
Mike Pence could come in and could really make a huge difference here for the Republican person.
I will tell you what. Next week, I'm going to be watching. Donald Trump is going to be here to address the NRA. They have a giant convention. I think maybe 60,000 people are expected. I want to see if sometime during that trip, the Republican nominee in the 6th District race is by his side. That will tell me, that's proof. That's proof that somebody will have made the calculation and said Donald Trump will help you more than he will hurt you.
And I think if you see that Republican nominee stand shoulder to shoulder with Donald Trump, then you're going to see John Ossoff raise another $8 million in 2 days.
Theron, you know, my memory isn't what it ought to be, but I don't know that. Did you weigh in on whether you think Ossoff can win this thing without a runoff tomorrow?
You know, I've been answering that question, you know, as honestly as I possibly can up until now. I mean, I've been saying that.
Now you're changing?
Yeah, well, now you're not going to be honest.
But no, here we go, Jim. Jim, let's be fun. Let's be fair to me, Jim, okay? I made some very bold predictions on this show with you, and I've been right, okay? I am prepared to say this, guys. I think that I will text each and every one of you if I'm looking at the DeKalb numbers and I'm looking at the portions in Cobb, particular precincts. If John Ossoff is performing at the numbers that I hear from his campaign, that their ID voters are actually turned out to vote, and he holds his own in North Fulton, I predict that those three things have got to happen. He could win this without a runoff. But honestly, I think with so many people in the race right now, and to Loretta and Brian's point and Jim's point about it kind of being, you know, sort of just unpredictable of who getting votes from where, I just don't think he'll make it. I think he'll probably come up short. But if he's getting the early vote numbers out like I think, and if people turn out to vote, I think he has a chance.
Okay, we got to take another break. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We got a tweet from Samuel Bell, who said to me, "Why were you just so dismissive of the question regarding where the first family are living? Do better." That was a response. Catherine Cummings, one of our loyal listeners, said that, and I wasn't trying to make fun of Catherine Cummings. We all sort of have fun with each other on this show, so I hope that she's perfectly fine with our kidding her a little bit. But Samuel, thanks for pointing that out. All right, let's go. It's 2:46 on Monday afternoon. We'll be back after a very short break.
This is it. Today's the last day to support GPB and enter our drawing at gpb.org to win a King and Prince getaway for two to St. Simon's Island. The lucky winner will enjoy a three-night oceanfront stay, scrumptious meals, and a round of golf, courtesy of the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. No contributions required to enter the drawing, but because you listen, we are counting on your support. Your donation now is so important and does make a difference. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Theron Johnson, there were demonstrations all over the country this weekend. People angrily demanding that President Trump release his income tax returns. Was that a good use of energy this weekend? Was that the right thing to be out demonstrating about, regardless of whether you think he ought to release his taxes or not? Was it counterproductive?
Listen, I think, and Brian and Loretta's going to be shocked to hear me say this, but I think Donald Trump actually had two good weeks. I mean, I think that if you're a staunch supporter of Donald Trump, he did exactly what you wanted him to do, and that is bomb the hell out of ISIS, right? Because that's what he campaigned on. And then he's also, been a little bit more tempered. But I do think, Bill, that we've got, as Democrats, we've got to keep the pressure on. We got to hold him accountable. And I think that, honestly, it was a way to make sure we keep the progressive left involved in the campaign. And the truth of the matter is that Donald Trump really should release his tax returns.
I will tell you what, it was an interesting shift, because generally speaking, tax day has been an occasion for Republicans mm-hmm. to protest the high taxation of Democratic rule.
Great point.
And now we have Democrats seizing that ground.
So okay, speaking of not revealing things, Loretta, at the same time that there were protesters and saying release your taxes, we know that President Trump doesn't feel he needs to. He did send out a tweet about that as well, which I thought was kind of, again, telling about what matters to him. I don't have it right in front of me, but essentially he said, "I won the Electoral College with more votes than most Republicans, and they're still talking about my taxes," as if one has to do with the other.
Right. And I think the point he was trying to make, if I could try to discern that, was that I got elected without releasing the tax returns. The majority of Americans, it was not that big a concern to them. You know, it wasn't enough of a concern for them not to elect me. Let's move on with the business of the day.
But again, it's transactional. I won, so I don't consider it a matter of ethics that I don't reveal my taxes. I don't consider it something that I must do in the interest of transparency. It's strictly, I won the election anyway.
Well, I don't know about that. I think that's a lot to infer from 140 characters, is to say that he doesn't care about ethics and he doesn't care about
transparency. No, I didn't say that. I said in terms of the tax issue specifically.
Right. That's what I'm saying, with regard to the tax issue. I don't want to infer all of those things, that's what his position is, that he's not being transparent or he's not. I think that he has a bigger issue right now, where he was probably somewhat annoyed that he had to, even his motorcade had to be deterred because of protesters down in Florida, that this is an issue that's out there when there are so many other pressing issues on the table. And I do believe that he's getting hit up as we approach the 100-day mark of his administration. And people continue to ask this question, as you did at the outset of this program: what has been accomplished in 100 days? So this issue is that, you know, it's in essence his way of saying, really, is that the biggest, most important thing on your plate right now? We're doing all of these other things?
Yeah. But the other part of that is these are Democrats who are setting the table for the next fight. And the next fight is going to be over tax reform. And that means Donald Trump's taxes, income taxes, are going to be just an intimate part of that battle, because every jot, every tittle, every phrase in a new tax bill, the question is going to be, does that help or does that hurt Donald Trump? We don't know.
Well, let's not forget, guys, I mean, Donald Trump was the, as my grandmother would say, the head leader. I mean, he was the person who actually every single day reminded the American people that he did not think Barack Obama, even when he was president, was a actual U.S. citizen. What President Obama had to do right before the 2012 election, which I was a part of, he had to do what? He had to release the actual birth certificate. So I think if the Democrats continue with the pressure, and I think we should not let up on it, before he decides to run for reelection, if he's not impeached, then he will have to release his tax returns.
Well, okay, so let's move one step further down the line on this. We also learned this weekend that the White House was not going to release its visitor logs for public scrutiny. President Obama did. There's been a mixed record of other presidents as to whether they'd had routinely released the logs of visitors. So, you know, the criticism I've heard from some people saying, how dare he not do this? It isn't as if that's been a standard practice for many administrations back to back. I think George W. Bush was somewhat spotty in terms of the records that of
so
visitors
was
that
Obama.
He released.
And, yes.
Well,
Obama was, and he did it on a 3-month delay. Correct? He released the White House released the visitors' logs on a 3-month delay. So 3 months after. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your thought.
No, the question though is, you know, we have two questions, Jim. I'll start with you. One is, what is this as a journalist? How concerning is it to you in terms of the work you do if you have no way of knowing who's there talking about specific policy issues?
And more important is how many times they're there.
That's exactly right.
That's when it takes on some of importance. There was a New York Times piece this weekend that I think that kind of fits hand in glove with this, and that was just a count of the number of lobbyists that the Trump administration has brought into the system, and given secret waivers that exempt them from the, I think there was a five year ban on working for the government after you've lobbied on an issue.
Brian, from a journalistic point of view, it's hard to do stories when you don't know who's influencing the president through series of meetings, that sort of thing.
But, which is kind of the point.
Right? Yeah, well, like, yeah. But what does it tell you, and what do you what are your thoughts about the whole issue of the Trump administration feeling that the public is perfectly content, their voters are perfectly content with their going their own way on matters, on issues that used to be in the public domain and are now being kept secret?
Well, they can get away with it. And this is, it goes to, Larry was talking about him tweeting about his taxes. There was no need for him to do that. There was no need for him to even address that tax release issue because his voters are watching Fox News Channel. Fox News Channel isn't covering that story. Fox News Channel, I can promise you, is not covering the visitor logs for the White House. They're not reading the New York Times and the Washington Post for the most part. I mean, there's obviously drawing overly black and white lines here. But for the most part, we know where his voters are getting their information, and they're not talking about these issues. So he will get away with it. And it'll continue to cause Democrats and a large number of independents to fume over the way the White House is operating. But he doesn't really care.
So just for clarity's sake, so one of what the White House has cited as their reasoning for not releasing the logs was that there were security concerns for some of those folks.
Grave. They use the adjective grave national
security.
Okay,
grave national security. Yeah. And so now the media is debating primarily amongst itself, well, can they then, you know, scour the lists and block out certain people and so forth and so on. So where do you draw the line? Who do you block out? Who do you not block out? How do you know who's a grave concern, a mild concern, an insignificant concern? You know, I suspect we're going to have this banter going on for a little while. And I don't see the Trump administration reversing course on this in the near term.
Brian, what was the policy in the first term as governor? Did you release lists of visitors who came to see him?
We were never asked for that, and we didn't keep a detailed log. We didn't keep a detailed log of our visit.
I think
keep him on his chief. Keep him on his chief.
Seriously, I don't know that we were ever asked. I could be wrong on that. I do know that we released the governor's schedule. We live under an open records law, so if there's anything written down, if there is a list of people written down, we have to turn it over. We turned over his schedule. We turned over all our emails. We turned over office budgets and who got what. All of that is open record. It's all very transparent.
Jim?
There is a calendar that every governor keeps of all his doings for a day. It exists somewhere. And the news media have asked for that calendar, I think, under every governor, at least, I got to say, since Zell. And we have been refused every time.
Mm.
The excuses change, and maybe it doesn't exist now. Might be one of them, but it's something that governors in Georgia have kept close at hand.
Their calendars.
Yeah, but just there's an appointment secretary. The governor has an appointment secretary, and that secretary keeps a calendar of virtually every minute of a governor's life.
Okay,
the scheduler, yes, but that schedule is given to Greg every month. Greg Bluestein, your colleague.
For the public portion of it.
Okay, we're running out of time. I want to get a couple tweets in. Ted Barfield says Obama released partial logs of what he wanted to release. Useless if it's not complete. Thanks for that. Mike McNulty tweets Trump's foreign entanglements are a pressing issue. Great show! Exclamation point. Thank you for that, Ted. We're just about out of time for today's show, Brian. How are you here? Don't you have to be up in the district, like pulling strings and making things happen for your candidate?
You know, when I was staff for Governor Deal and on Capitol Hill, I was always jealous of these consultants who just got to call in and they never were there in person. They're like ghosts.
We got you.
He's teleworking.
Yeah. I got all
now
right.
Now I'm one of the ghosts.
All right.
I have a quick message for all of the listeners who live in the 6th District. I just want you to do one thing. Vote your ass off.
Yeah. All right.
I would say to all the voters in the 6th District, please get out and vote.
Let's be sure. We're completely out of time. Let's be sure that what Theron said was vote your ass off. It's a sign that's been passed around.
I didn't say the other word. Vote your ass off.
Right. All right. That's it for us. Theron Johnson, Brian Robinson, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway. Thank you so much. We're back here, of course, at 2 o'clock on Wednesday when we will break down this race. Lori Geary, former WSB-TV political reporter, will be here. So will your colleague, Jim, Greg Bluestein. And we will talk. And Galloway is saying, maybe I need to be a part of a show like that. It's going to be really interesting to see how this race turns out tomorrow night. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again Wednesday at 2:00.